the final Fish Fry Friday of Lent. Next Friday will be Good Friday, and ain't a time for fish fries. But we'll see what we can feast on the program today. No abstinence from good topics, that's for sure. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to be on the program at all anytime during the next 2 hours, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Later this hour, at the bottom of the hour to be exact, my friend Dr. Alan Alday will be here. Alan Alday, who is a professor at the University of Kentucky. He's also a certified behavior analyst. He spends a lot of time with schools, actually, in classrooms, and spends time with parents and families as well, dealing with behavior issues. He's a parent himself, very self-effacing one, if you've heard Alan on the program before. But we're going to talk some about parental motivation today and children's motivation. And, you know, one of Alan's principal convictions is that, you know, we start out concerned about our child's behavior, but we also need to look at our own behavior, and because behaviors within systems and within families impact each other. And he's not a therapist by his own admission. He's not a psychologist. He deals in the realm of behavior theory, but it's pretty fascinating stuff and very well researched, and some very excellent and also very practical principles. So you may have a question. Maybe you're dealing with a behavior issue in your home or in your classroom. You're certainly welcome to call or email those questions in while Alan's here later this hour for the little second half of this first hour. 573-4-BREAD-4. You can call or text if you want to remain anonymous with your question. You can do so. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post a question on Facebook or on Twitter, either one, or message me there. Again, we'd love to hear from you, whatever the behavior issue is. Now, the behavior of your husband, I don't know if we can do anything about that. 573-4-BREAD-4, especially this time of year when the NCAA tournament makes people behave in very strange ways. I took myself a pregame nap last night since my Kentucky Wildcats weren't playing until 9:40 p.m. and knew I had to get up early for the show. So my wife was gracious enough to allow me a little pregame nap. But anyway, this is a time of year when people do all kind of crazy things because of their love for basketball. And we'll look over the first day's results of Big Blue Madness. My bracket already blown up. That's not a good sign. My bracket was blown up before the sun went down on the first day of the tournament. So one of these days I'll learn. Anyway, we'll also talk about our Lord's hidden suffering, the Republican Party's SCOTUS gamble. SCOTUS, an acronym, of course, for the Supreme Court of the United States. More on the ground rules of understanding difficult moral teachings. And then my guest in the second hour, Adam Chandler, who writes for The Atlantic, on the complex politics of genocide. The U.S. State Department and Secretary of State John Kerry coming out with a statement officially acknowledging that what ISIS is doing in parts of the Middle East is a genocide of Christians and some other faith groups there. Just brutal. But there are political implications with calling something genocide. And we'll talk to Adam Chandler about that. He'll help us understand sort of the long and complex history behind that word and how it impacts our response to events like that. And my question today will relate to that. We'll get into that in the second segment. Again, would love to hear from you on anything you want to call or email me about. Looking at the readings for today, the first reading taken from Jeremiah chapter 20. Very appropriate reading for a Friday. This is a reading for today's Mass. Fridays, of course, forever overshadowed by the cross and that knowledge that this was that day on which our Lord suffered, and particularly Lenten Fridays, even more so, all pointing toward, of course, that Friday of Fridays that we will recognize and enter into next week, Good Friday. But Jeremiah, writing about the betrayal that he experienced as a prophet to the people, as we've talked about before, the job of prophet was not one anybody sought. And like so many other things, in fact, if it's a job you wanted, then you didn't need to be one. because it meant you somehow went for the wrong reasons. The reason Jeremiah did not want to be a prophet, and so many of the prophets did not want to be a prophet, was both because of his own feelings of unworthiness and also because who wants to preach against your own people, the people you love? Much easier to mind your own business, to go along, to get along. And we even sometimes baptize that mindset in our world and in the church under the banner of non-judgmentalism. Who wants to be the old crank, the curmudgeon, who speaks out when they see injustice? But that's exactly what Jeremiah was called to do. And he, as you read through the chapters of Jeremiah, you see his own internal wrestling with God himself over the matter. He says, I think, a few chapters earlier that he had resolved to be quiet, to speak no more in the Lord's name because of the great trouble it brought him. You even have that great exchange in which he says, Lord, you have duped me, and I have allowed myself to be duped. I can't tell you how many people who have answered some kind of call to a vocation. I would imagine particularly priesthood or religious life, who thought somehow they were entering into some Shangri-La of sanctity, and that, you know, it was just going to be one spiritual high after another, and discovered that it was a process of emptying and pruning and at times feelings of abandonment, who have said in those words of Jeremiah, Lord, you have duped me, and I have allowed myself to be duped. But there's a whole other level of pain that Jeremiah had to endure that you see in this first reading today from Jeremiah chapter 20. The prophet says, I hear the whisperings of many, terror on every side. Denounce, let us denounce him. All those who were my friends are on the watch for any misstep of mine. Perhaps he will be trapped, then we can prevail and take our vengeance on him. Key word there is were, right? All those who were my friends are on the watch for any misstep of mine. I can't imagine that there are many sufferings that are more painful than betrayal. Someone that you trusted, someone that you thought loved you, someone that you thought had your back, and turns out that they are just like everybody else. When things get difficult, they turn on you. I remember watching a number of years ago a documentary of, it was actually done by Steven Spielberg. It was called The Last Days, and it was about Jews in Hungary in the last couple of years of World War II. And I think actually only about a little over a year before the war, Hungary was occupied by the Nazis. And the Nazis not only didn't slow down their genocidal efforts, their final solution of the Jews, that even as the war was winding down, even as it was becoming apparent they were going to lose, rather than divert resources in a desperate last chance to try to reduce their casualties in the war, they amped up the money and the resources they invested in the extermination of the Jews. And these Hungarian Jews who survived the Holocaust, it's their stories on which the documentary is based. Powerful stuff, but so many of them, you can still hear decades later the pain in their voice when they talk about how they lived so that up to a certain point they lived in great peace and harmony with their neighbors, until the day came that something shifted. And what distressed them was not just the Nazis and their cruelty. It was the fact that those who were their neighbors, those who were their friends, rather than speak up on their behalf, turned their backs on them, and in some cases even joined in the abuse and the cruelty. That is a level of pain that I can't even begin to imagine, and it had to be. Of course, Jeremiah expresses it here, but Jeremiah in many ways a foreshadowing of our Lord's own passion. We have, of course, and this, you know, would be an opportunity for you to do this tonight, we have the stations of the cross, right? The 14 different stations of our Lord's path and journey toward the cross and ultimately his being laid in the tomb. It's a beautiful devotion. It's a beautiful entering in and a reminder of what our Lord endured. We also remember the sorrowful mysteries as we pray the rosary and we remember from the agony in the garden all the way through the crucifixion, different stages along the way. If I could ever add one, either a 15th station of the cross or a sixth sorrowful mystery, it would be this one. Jesus is abandoned by his friends. And it makes you wonder whether God in the flesh, the Son of God incarnate, whether perhaps his greatest suffering in the midst of all that he endured was an interior one. The interior abandonment of his friends. And you could say, oh, well, come on, he was God. He didn't need them. No, in his human nature, he loved his friends. Those haunting words, I think, when Jesus says to Judas there in the garden, when Judas brings the temple guard to arrest him, and Judas tells the temple guard, the one I kiss, that's the one you arrest. And he kisses Jesus. And as I've said, the most haunting words maybe of all of Jesus' words in the New Testament. Judas, you would betray the Son of Man with a kiss. We'll be back to this topic at the beginning of the next hour because our own experiences of betrayal can find meaning in our Lord's. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Hope you have fully recovered from whatever St. Patrick's celebration that you had, or from staying up late and watching basketball, which is what I did last night. Certainly recovering a lot better since my Kentucky Wildcats won than I would have been if they had lost. So there's that. I've got my cup of coffee in hand, so good to go. As I said, next hour, we're going to be talking on the program with Adam Chandler. Adam, who writes for The Atlantic, which, as I've said before, I'm kind of a fanboy of that publication. I think it's very balanced, very thorough, covers a whole lot of different issues in the world. And Adam Chandler, with an article about what he calls the long thorny path to calling ISIS genocidal. Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry and the State Department announcing that ISIS is, in fact, been practicing genocide. After a vote from the U.S. House 393-0 to designate the crimes of the Islamic State genocide, yesterday, John Kerry announcing this, and I quote, "My purpose here today is to assert, in my judgment, Daesh," which is another term for ISIS. In fact, some people have taken to calling ISIS that because they actually prefer ISIS. Calling them Daesh actually is an insult of sorts. Anyway, Daesh is responsible for genocide against groups in areas under its control, including Yazidis, Christians, and Shiite Muslims. Kerry said this at the State Department, referring to ISIS, as I said, by one of the other names by which it is known. They had been given really a deadline of March 17th by the Congress to try to make some sort of statement along that. The question that it raises, of course, and we'll get into this with Adam Chandler in the next hour, you know, genocide is not a term without political ramifications. Once you assign something genocide, which according to a definition, I guess, really is, it means the killing of a group either because of their nationality, their race, or their religion. In essence, that's what genocide is. Systematic. It's a systematic killing. The kind of things that have taken place, like, for example, at Darfur in the southern part of Sudan. And as Adam Chandler makes the point, this is perhaps the only genocide that has been called such in real time. In other words, while it's going on. Typically in the past, genocides have been identified after the fact. And there are a lot of different questions making it a thorny political issue. For example, is, you know, what does calling this genocide obligate the U.S. to do? And because as Chandler pointed out, when we first started our strikes against ISIS fighters in Iraq, John Kerry justified the escalation under the theory that ISIS activities bore, quote, all the warning signs of genocide. So you could say on one hand, perhaps calling it genocide empowers the more hawkish members of our government who want to take more military action. But at the same time, another ramification is it amps up the pressure on the United States to accept immigrants from countries where genocide is occurring. Refugees of genocide, much different thing than just refugees of civil war. So it kind of prompts my question of the day, which I think is an important one. And that's this: does the United States have a moral obligation to intervene militarily to try and stop genocide? Imagine that we discover there is genocide going on somewhere in the world. Do we have an obligation? I know it's popular to say we're not the world's policemen. I get that, and I am sympathetic to that point of view, believe me. We've been far too war happy over the last 10 or 15 years. But there's a difference between simply being the world's policeman and doing nothing while horrific human rights abuses and war crimes are taking place right under our nose. And with the U.S. being the world's last remaining, quote unquote, superpower, what does that mean? Do we have a moral obligation to intervene militarily and try and stop suicide? You can chime in 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Looking at the bracketology with Father Brauner updates onto a lighter topic, looking at the standings. Of course, my own bracket, as I said, blown up. I made some very ill-advised picks. Now only three of my final four still alive. Upsets I did pick. I guess if you throw enough spaghetti noodles at the wall, one of them's going to stick, because I picked Wichita State to beat Arizona last night. Certainly not a good year for the Arizona Wildcats. And evidently, though, I didn't see it because I was watching the other game. Sean Miller, the coach of Arizona, just sweating like a sieve. I mean, he had changed shirts at halftime. I'm sure his team's performance did not help his perspiring. I thought about picking Gonzaga. You know, Gonzaga's tendency seems to be when little is expected of them, that's when they surprise. It's when they're highly seeded that they flame out. And as an 11 seed, no one expected much, and of course, that's when they go and upset Seton Hall, a team that I had getting all the way to the Sweet 16. And I ill-advisedly picked Tubby Smith's Texas Tech Red Raiders to win their game against Butler, going on Tubby's first round of the NCAA tournament track record. Of course, I forgot that Tubby's excellent first-round NCAA track record was largely down at Kentucky, where, let's face it, I could probably win some first-round games along the way. So we'll see if South Dakota State can pull off the upset over Maryland today, because I picked that one. But let me look at the standings really quick, because right now only two people after the first day are currently beating Father Brauner. That's the rule, right? You have to be beating Father Brauner to have your name go in the hat to win the prize. And let's see, Brian Carlson and Ida Terrazas both getting 14 out of 16 right. On a day full of upsets, that is very impressive picking, I got to say. And then you got a whole slew of people. Looks like maybe about 9 or 10 people who are tied with Father Frank after the first day. So we'll be keeping a close eye on that Chick-fil-A gift basket on the line. But of course, as we move along, the way we've set it up, it's 1 point for round one, 2 points for round two, 3 points for round three, and on like that, till finally, I think, 10 points for the championship game. So an increasing degree of reward as we go along. The other thing, I saw at 538.com, my favorite stat website, did a thing about the NCAA selection committee and how their poor job of seeding, and I think there's a pretty good consensus that the selection committee who put together the tournament brackets did not do a very good or accurate job of seeding teams based on their strength. I'll give you just a case in point, and I know it sounds whiny, but The fact that in the second round, the Kentucky Wildcats, who were the SEC champions, are going to play the Indiana Hoosiers, who were the Big Ten regular season champions. The fact that they're going to play in the second round of the NCAA tournament makes no sense at all. That should be, at the very least, a Sweet 16 game. But 538, not just willing to go with anecdotes, actually did some hard statistical analysis on who was hurt the most and helped the most by the NCAA's bad seeding. And so they came down with the teams in terms of their chances of reaching the Sweet 16. Teams that were hurt the most were Vanderbilt, Wichita State, Connecticut, Indiana, and Miami of Florida. These are all teams that perhaps could make the Sweet 16, but this is how much their chance of dropping, of making the Sweet 16 dropped because of their seeding, which was not properly deserved. And then the teams that were helped the most, Gonzaga. They're at the top. Then Maryland. We'll find out if Maryland can get past the Jackrabbits of South Dakota State today. And then Cincinnati, Oregon, and Oklahoma. Now, when it gets to chances of reaching the Final Four, whose chances hurt the most, one of the teams hurt the most, my own Kentucky Wildcats. So maybe Coach John Calipari is vindicated. And among the teams most helped through the seeding with a chance to get to the Final Four, almost doubling their chance. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, the Duke Blue Devils. See, it's not a conspiracy theory when there's actually a conspiracy. Just so you know. All right, let's get into the What Were You Thinking Awards of the Day. We've got a couple to mention here. I guess I'll go ahead and nominate myself for one. And that was for picking the Purdue Boilermakers to get to the Final Four. You know, I was watching that score yesterday, and Purdue had a healthy lead on Arkansas Little Rock. I was saying, yeah, okay, Purdue, they're going to, you know, maybe it's not a crazy pick. They'll get along to the next round. Next thing I know, they've blown a big lead down the stretch and lost in double overtime to the Trojans of Arkansas Little Rock. Meaning that one of my Final Four, even before the sun went down the first day of the tournament, gone. Purdue hadn't been to the Final Four in 36 years. Maybe I should have paid attention to that. All right, second we're going to say is this article. This is from Fox17.com. Neighbor steals PlayStation and is busted after keeping it connected to the victim's Wi-Fi. So a neighbor steals this guy's PlayStation and just decides he'll pirate the guy's Wi-Fi, too. I mean, making him, of course, eminently traceable. This is out of Nashville, Tennessee. A Mid-State gamer thankful for connecting his PlayStation 4 to a cell phone after it helped recover his stolen console. Oh, my goodness. Dumb criminals. But the winner we're going to give to a TV station in Indiana who, at the death earlier this week of Frank Sinatra Jr., the death of the singing great, the son of the singing great, used a picture of Joe Piscopo playing Frank Sinatra as Frank Sinatra Jr.'s picture. Oh, me. We'll be back. This is the Mike Kaplan Show. What was I thinking? We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday. Like I said, if you want a fish fry, this is your last Friday to get it. Next week will be Good Friday. Good chance, too, to go to the Stations of the Cross. I'm here in the studio with my good friend, Dr. Allen Alday. Allen, who teaches at the University of Kentucky. He is a behavior analyst. Deals in the realm of behaviors, works with a lot of public schools, private schools, families on the realm of behavior, and particularly how behavior of adults sometimes impacts a child's behavior. Allen, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Oh, get you turned up there. All right, good morning. So a little sickness going on at your house?
Yeah, we've passed around quite a few things. We've had a couple of weeks of flu.
Hold on, I think he's on three there, Ethan. There we go. All right, we'll get it.
Hey, there we go.
Ah, there we go. All right. Man. So you've been passing some stuff around?
I sounded way better before. Yeah, we've been passing the flu around. So I think because I go to so many schools and I stay out around so many sick kids that my immune system is probably like steel when it comes to stuff like that. So thankfully I haven't had it. But we've had two weeks of it.
Both your boys had it?
Just one.
Just one, so it's, wow.
Yeah, so we're and then Carrie, bless her heart.
Mama gets it last. We'll pray for Carrie for sure. Keep her in our prayers because that's no fun.
Yeah, she's a trooper, though, so I have to give it to her. She doesn't break easy. I think I would have broken already. You know, that's why women have children and not men.
I mean, not to be, you know, to play into stereotypes, but in terms of how we respond to sickness, I mean, I'm a total wimp compared to my wife.
Oh, me too. I mean, you know, if men had to have children, we'd be extinct pretty much after Adam. I mean, that would have been it. Like, ooh, that hurt. I'm good.
I have had a couple kidney stones, so I will throw that out there. But
I hear that's about the same. I hear it's very similar. So
the reward at the end is not quite as satisfying. But
No.
Now, are you a bracket filler outer? Do you fill out brackets?
You know, I used to. I didn't do it this year, and I feel like, you know, at some point it's almost a pointless activity, because what do you have, like one in a trillion chances of getting them all right or something?
Oh, yeah, that's never going to happen.
I remember, I think it was one year, Carrie and I did, we filled it out, and, you know, she just went by the name or the color or something like
sure.
that, and she blew me out of the water, and I thought, well, you know, there you go. And so it's just...
Well, I'm trying to recover from staying up late last night to watch that game, so...
Yeah, no. You're hardcore.
I did get a pregame nap, though, so that helped.
Well, and that's nice. That was nice of your wife to give you the opportunity to do this.
Very gracious of her. Well, you say you want to talk about motivation today.
Yeah, well, hey, that's kind of a nice segue there. Motivate, you know, you took a nap because you were motivated to stay up late and watch the game.
That's right. What is it your thing is about behavior? You either get something out of it or you avoid something because of the behavior. I guess that doesn't change from when you're a child to when you're an adult.
No, I mean, it's to me, that's the beautiful thing about looking at things from a behavioral point of view, is that if you're a human being, no matter if you're from birth to death, I mean, behavior still... You know,
you still have behavior.
You still have behavior. As long as you have breath in your lungs, you have behavior. And, you know, and the same principles apply to us as adults just as much as they do to children. But, you know, I mean, as we're adults, we think we're so smart and we think we're all this. But, I mean, the truth is we're still the same. I mean, you know, we still are motivated by similar things. We still engage in similar behaviors. I mean, it's you know, some things never change. I mean, it's even you know, kind of silly stuff. A couple of weeks ago, I went. I had one of my best friends from childhood. His father passed away, so I went down to Alabama to his funeral. And you know, I hadn't seen him in just a couple times in the last 10 years. And you know, and I had another friend who came down from Atlanta, and so you know, our first time to get together, and our behavior reverted back to us being teenagers. In the terms of like the things we talked about and all, and it was just, it's kind of funny because, you know, we don't really change that much even as we get older.
You didn't go out egging cars or anything like that?
No, just put a couple of plastic forks in people's yards and rolled yards and, you know, anyway.
The rest. Well, good. So let's talk about it from your perspective in terms of parenting. And then, by the way, I just want to say, if there's anybody out there that wants to call with a question, you can do so. Call or text. If you want to text anonymously, you can do that as well on a behavior issue. 573-4BREAD-4 is the number to call or text, 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, with the question you may have.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that, you know, I'm hoping to make this kind of a two-part, because I mean, this is kind of a big topic, and in reality, as I was thinking about this, it's kind of a deep part of the pool to jump into. So we'll see if we can do this. But you know, a lot of people, certainly within the realm of the psychological sciences, they discuss motivation and what motivates you, and intrinsic motivation, which means you're motivated from within, and extrinsic motivation means you're motivated from, you know, without. And And so from the standpoint of behavior analysis, I mean, we have a different approach to dealing with motivation, as with most other things. But we look at motivation as, motivation changes two things. Motivation changes, the behaviors you engage in, and motivation changes the reinforcement that's available to you. So, as reinforcement changes, so does your behavior. And I've got a couple of, a couple of examples, and hopefully this will make sense. I mean, I spend time teaching this stuff, and I'm trying to water it down a lot more than normal, so just bear with me here. But with motivation, if you really stop and think about it, whenever you get hungry, what becomes more valuable to you would be food. So food becomes more valuable as a reinforcer because you're hungry. So whenever you're hungry, what behavior do you engage in more? You engage in more of seeking food.
Mm-hmm.
So from a motivation standpoint of the most basic level, because obviously all of us, go after food, from the most basic level is, I'm sitting, I'm watching the Kentucky game. My stomach just rumbled. I'm hungry. So what does that do? It makes you engage in the behavior of seeking food, and it makes you seek out a food that is the most reinforcing to you at that moment. There's a lot of other parts to this, but what happens is over time, and as adults, we don't really think of this because, we're adults and we've been living this for a long time, but we don't remember learning different things. So like, for instance, when I get really hungry and I begin to seek out food, I don't typically go to the bathroom, right? Because there's no food in the bathroom. I hope. Or maybe you do have food in your bathroom. I don't know. I mean, this is according to, you may have your secret stash in there.
So when you've got a big family like we do, 7 kids, sometimes your kids, our older ones, who maybe buy a snack for themselves, believe me, they have creative hiding places because they don't want to share.
Well, that's like, honey, why are you in the bathroom? I'm getting something to eat. Whoa, God.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no, I'm worried about you.
How low have we sunk?
I didn't know we were that desperate, but anyway, but we don't do that. I mean, even, we don't go to places where there's not food. We don't go seeking, to the bedroom to seek food. We go to the kitchen to seek food. And we go in the kitchen, we don't automatically look in the oven because, maybe it's, that's not something in there. We typically go to the, to the pantry or to a cabinet that we know has food because over time, that behavior has been reinforced. When I go and open up the left cabinet, above the sink, I can get a cup out to get some water or whatever. So when we don't think about motivation in this, we try to make it much more complicated, much more broad. But in reality, it starts with, these simple behaviors of, I'm hungry, so therefore I seek out food, and I'm reinforced on where I go to seek out food. I mean, you think about if anybody's ever moved between houses, and you have always had, we'll just say you've always had your cups to the left of the sink in the shelf. Well, now you move to a house, there's no, you decided you're going to rearrange things. So now you go and you open up the left, cabinet above the sink, and you're like, wait a minute, where's the cups? And then you close it back, and maybe you don't make a big to-do of it, but you can see that, whenever you've been reinforced to go and seek a behavior and to a specific place to find a specific item, and now it's moved, you're like, well, where is it? That happens a lot at our house. Carrie's very organized, but sometimes she moves things. I'm like, I've been looking for that for 5 minutes. She said, I moved it over here. But we
had that same experience at the grocery store about a year ago. They moved everything around, the same grocery I go to all the time, and drove me crazy.
Right, because when you go in, you go, the cereal is on aisle this, and now it's on aisle, it was on aisle two, now it's on aisle four. And so you're like, oh man, what are you doing moving it? Because we've been reinforced to go to the same thing and to do the same things. And so again, from a motivation standpoint, we have to look at, you know, what are our behaviors and what behaviors are we going to engage in that motivate us, and as well as, you know, what things that make reinforcement more valuable to us. And of course, there's more to it, and we'll continue. But this is a very simple concept, but it's hard for us because sometimes it is so simple.
You know, one of the things that's interesting, I do back to this whole thing of that most basic human desire of eating. It's interesting that, of course, in the Catholic faith, but even in other religious faith, even non-Christian religions, that dietary issues are part of disciplines. You know, they're part of growth in virtue, you know, because we are so automatic and instinctive, it's almost like something has to come in there to interrupt that, to pause us to think. So yeah. We'll be back in about 10 seconds. Going to a break in 10 seconds. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with Dr. Allen Alday. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're back on the Mike Allen Show. Listen to the sweet vocal sounds of Mr. Charlie Pride, whose birthday is today. Happy birthday, Charlie Pride, 78 years old. Now, you grew up in Alabama. You probably heard a little Charlie Pride Allen all day back in the day.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, he really was a trendsetter. I mean, truly.
Well, one of the few African-American country singers there's ever been, you know?
I mean, it's, and he's good. I mean, he's a great singer, and I mean, I don't know. I was doing
a little basic reading about him last night just for the heck of it, you know, and found out he was quite an impressive baseball player. He actually played in the Negro Leagues. And
really?
Yeah, I almost got to I think he got to AAA in the Yankees, and then he lost the fire off of his pitch, and he was quite never the same, but evidently a pretty impressive guy. One of 11 children.
Wow.
Growing up as a son of a sharecropper in Mississippi.
Well, I tell you what, the man can sure sing. Undoubtedly, he can make the baseball sing too.
I think he found his true calling.
I would say he did. And you know, and I can remember hearing him quite a bit as a kid. And he's great.
We're here with Dr. Allen Alday, who teaches at the University of Kentucky. He's a certified behavior analyst, deals with the realm of behaviors in families and classrooms and how sometimes adult behavior affects the behavior of children. We're talking about motivation. And you were talking before the break, Alan, about how, you know, we get in certain patterns because maybe there's a predictability to where we're seeking something and we know where to find it. And it's just automatic.
Yeah. And it does become automatic to the point to where we don't really think about stuff that we do a lot. Even outside the realm of motivation, think of how many times you get in your car and you drive somewhere, but you don't really think about the behaviors you engage in when you drive.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you just, you know, you kind of blank out and come to, and you're like, how did I get home again? You know, not, cause you don't pay attention to turning left here and turning right here. And you know, because it becomes just a more automatic response. And it's the same, kind of the same way with motivation. But, you know, just to say back what you said before the break, you know, when you think about it from a behavior analytic standpoint, you look at why do people engage in the behavior during Lent of fasting? Well, you know, because food is one of the most basic motivators, one of the most basic reinforcers we have. However, those of us, you know, who follow Jesus, we find that, you know, that is actually more motivating than food.
Mm.
I mean, not that we still don't have the desire to eat food, but your desire to be closer to Jesus actually is a more powerful reinforcer than the food would be, which would be why you would choose to engage in not eating food because you find, you know, the idea of getting to be a closer relationship with Jesus to be more motivating. And that's, you know, that's kind of, again, the way that this works is we always are making this decision as to what's, you know, what's going to be the most reinforcing for us now. I mean, you know, we have the gift in this country of, you know, say, you know, just what, three blocks from here, you've got 10 different restaurants,
right?
You know, and you look and you say, I don't really feel like McDonald's today. I don't really feel like, you know, I don't feel like McDonald's today. I don't feel like Chick-fil-A today. I don't feel like this today. I feel like Panera today. Okay, I'll go there. I mean, and so we even, as we're choosing our restaurant, we choose the restaurant that's going to be the most reinforcing to us. Even within the realm of food, we still choose things that are more reinforcing. So I mean, this goes back again to our motivation. You know, and this, again, I think as I'm sitting here talking about this, I'm thinking, this might have been a little bit too deep to jump into. But I hope it makes sense to everybody, because your kids are the same way. And when you think about the things that motivate us the most, food, obviously, food, drink, there's one of the most important, but also social. You know, if you're sitting and you go for a while without any attention from your parents, if you're a kid, you go for X amount of time with no attention from your parents. And I know if I just reach over and whack my brother upside the head, then my parents will give me attention. So, you know, just, you know, basically you can think of it as now I'm attention hungry. I engage in the behavior of hitting my brother, and my parents come over and give me the attention, and they say, you know, Mike, you know better than that. You shouldn't hit your brother. That's not nice. You need to apologize, blah, blah, blah. Now I just got, you know, an attention buffet, so therefore I'm no longer hungry, so therefore I'm not going to engage in the behavior of hitting any again until I get attention hungry again. And then I'm going to whack you again. My parents will come and they will do that. And over time, kids learn that, you know, whenever I want my parents' attention, I am actually, some kids learn, they learn to get motivated by engaging in inappropriate behaviors. Because they desire to engage, you know, to attract your attention.
And I'm guessing here, and you tell me if I'm wrong. That's not even always conscious to the child. I mean, there may be, you know, they may not even themselves be thinking about the fact that I get attention consciously, but it's a pattern that they have developed and learned. Would that be accurate?
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't think the bulk of kids aren't sitting around thinking like, you know, they're sitting around thinking, hey, let me see how I can manipulate my parents. But when you think, and when I think back to when we were children, we can see how we did manipulate our parents. Not necessarily at that moment. We didn't think, hey, if I go and ask my dad for some money, he's going to say yes. My mom won't say yes, so I'm going to go ask my dad. But when we think back on that, we can see how we did that, because there is a pattern of behavior we've developed. So, yeah, that's very true. You know, even with us as adults, I mean, for instance, you know, if you like to cook and you like the social praise that you receive from your family whenever they, you know, with certain meals, you're more likely to cook meals that get you praise than you are to cook meals that they're like, ew, I don't want to eat that. You know, Brussels sprouts again? Thanks, Mom. You know, I mean, you know, but you're more likely to do that. And you're more likely to wear clothes that you receive compliments on than you are to wear clothes that people say, boy, you look a hot mess in that. You know, I mean, so we don't necessarily consciously do that, but nonetheless, it doesn't change the fact that's what happens. And I see it all the time. I see it, you know, especially in, you know, as I go in and I watch, I get to watch kids quite often, and it's really a pretty fascinating thing to watch a kid engage in a behavior. And you know, and you think, who's training who here? Because the kid has trained the parent. I mean, has trained the parent, or the kid has trained, you know, the teacher. I mean, and even me.
Who's,
I mean,
Pavlov and who's the dog?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you think about with newborns. I mean, you've had 7 experiences with this.
Yes.
Newborn cries. What do parents do? We shoot over there and feed them or change them or whatever, because we find the crying to be very aversive. And that's even going back to, you know, what you just said at the beginning, how you gain or you avoid things. Well, you know, as parents, you know, you think about what is our motivation to stop our baby from crying. Well, we find that crying to be very aversive. We don't like the crying. So therefore, it changes our behavior in the sense that we're going to do whatever it takes to make that baby not cry. And it also changes the value of silence, because silence becomes more reinforcing to us. So therefore, we engage in the behavior of, you know, we're going to try to feed the baby. Okay, that didn't work. Baby's still crying. We're going to change the diaper. That didn't work. Baby's still crying. Then we go to the good old, when you have nothing else to try, you give them gas drops. And yes, that worked. So, you know, so that increases the likelihood that the next time the baby cries, it increases our motivation to go find the gas drops first, maybe as opposed to second or third, you know. And so, you know, both in all this stuff, I guess the main thing is understanding, at least for today, we'll get back into this next time too, but understanding that motivation, you know, you could say, yes, it's an intrinsic thing. Yes, it's this, it's that. But in reality, motivation, what it does is it makes reinforcement more valuable to us. So we seek out reinforcement that is the most valuable, and it changes our behavior. And so that's really one of the reasons why we're motivated. And even, you know, you can even make certainly arguments as to even the behaviors of faith. I mean, I engage in behaviors because, you know, I think it's the right thing, because I think it would, you know, is the what would Jesus do kind of mm-hmm. thing. So it even motivates us. Things that we can't see necessarily still motivate us. So anyway, but next time the idea will be, you know, we'll take this into the next level of some specifics of, you know, why would your kids be engaging in problem behaviors, and you know, what would be motivating them? How can we change that?
You know, you're talking about the kind of spiritual connection, and one of the real, I love this quote from C.S. Lewis about motivation, desire, basically. He says, "It would seem our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased." But it kind of reminds me of what you were talking about fasting. It should elevate our motivation to what it is we desire. Again, the desire is not bad. It's right. That what we desire should be something higher.
Right. And, you know, and that's always our hope. So,
Alan, he is Alan Alday. He teaches at the University of Kentucky, regular guest on the program. He'll be back in a couple weeks. Alan, blessings to you and to your family during Holy Week. Hope Carrie feels better.
Thanks, Mike. You too.
Your first Holy Week as a Catholic.
That's right.
All right. We'll be back in a minute with a new hour. This is the Mike Allen Show.